you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. It is January the 3rd, and
so
January,
close, but
oh,
you.
Man, January the 3rd. All right, Jackie, let's do it again. What a fail. Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. It is June the 3rd. We just had a little moment there, a first try at this recording where I got the month wrong. And I don't know if that's still the sort of the knock-on effects of the pandemic, where all days are the same and 1 year slides into the next, and you're not quite sure whether it's been an eternity or like it's yesterday. I don't know if everybody has this thing, but I have spoken to a lot of people who, you know, days are flying by for them with a unsettling rapidity. And this is not just, you know, not just just middle-aged folks like me who start getting concerned that days are moving more quickly than they did in the past. But everybody in the pandemic seems to have this. And yet you have that. And then also at the same time, you feel like, good Lord, I've been in my house for a year and a half. And so this weird kind of dilations of time where time is moving very slowly and very quickly at the same time. In any case, we've got a few new developments now, and they are strangely similar. We have, on the one hand, we have various indications that, thankfully, that Democrats are moving into a phase where we're going to be biting a number of bullets, for lack of a better word. We've been in this kind of what has felt like a period of drift with these negotiations with Republicans that clearly are not, that we knew in advance were not going to go anywhere. And now we have seen, in the event that they have not gone anywhere. And after the failure of the January 6th commission, I guess last week, Chuck Schumer made an announcement and put out some schedules basically saying, okay, over the course of June, we're going to have votes on a lot of these things that seem to be held up and going nowhere. And they seem to be looking for a way to put these infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure negotiations to bed, to kind of, okay, how do we set this aside? This is clearly not working. So on a few different fronts, you have what I think at least is Democrats saying, okay, we can't just drift. We need to either pass some legislation or we need to have it be very visible who is blocking the legislation, whether that's Republicans, whether it's a couple Democrats. We need to get down to it and find out where we are. And that seems to be, that's going to happen over the course of June and into July. So we're going to talk about that. We also have some new oddities emerging from the ex-president, Donald Trump. We had this kind of comic thing where he, you know, to a lot of fanfare about a month ago, he announced what was in effect a blog. It was initially kind of described as a communications platform or something like that, but it was a blog, you know. Don't kid a kidder. And just a couple days ago, he closed it down forever. And his kind of arch toady Jason Miller put out a few statements that, yes, it's done. It's you know, it's not just briefly offline. And what it seems to be the case is that he got kind of a little cranky about the fact that the traffic was very low and that people were kind of making fun of it. And so he shut it down. This is a very typical Trump thing. I mean, hey, it takes a while to build traffic for a blog. I know, right? It's, you can't expect it to just come out of nowhere. More ominously, there was this report yesterday, and there were kind of versions of it emerging from different places, but it was sort of stitched all together by Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, who said that Trump is telling his associates that, I mean, the phrasing that was used in the announcements was that he expects to be reinstalled as president in August as sort of the result of these various audits of state election returns that are happening across the country. Now, it is important to say what that really means. That means he is at least telling people he expects there will be a coup in the late summer and he will be reinstalled as president. I mean, again, we don't have reinstalled. That's not a thing. You don't have, you know, we have no thing where there are audits of elections and we as a country change our mind and put the old president in. That doesn't happen. That's called a coup. Now, what are we to make of this? Now, I don't think there's going to be a coup. Again, there's no reinstalling. That doesn't happen. But governments can be overthrown. And what I do think is what is real about this is that we saw what can happen when the president raises expectations among his followers, either expectations or a sense of, you know, kind of deep and legitimate grievance. This incites violence. That's what happened. That's what January 6th was about. He got his people really, I mean, at the most generous, he got his people really riled up that he was being denied the presidency, that he raised expectations that that there would be this critical moment where Republicans made sure that the presidency was not stolen from him. And then it was clear that was not going to happen. And that is kind of, that was the backdrop to January 6th. Now, there were clearly a lot of things going on there. One, there was clearly, you know, there was actually on January 6th, and I can't remember if this was just before the insurrection took place or sort of outside of the Capitol complex while it was taking place, but I remember an interview, I think it was on CNN, with a, you know, protester slash insurrectionist. And that person basically said, hey, we were thinking, it was clear in that conversation that the person they were interviewing really thought that what was going to happen on January 6th was that Mike Pence was going to overrule the steal and Trump was going to remain president. And that person who was interviewed was clearly in a state of, not sure I'd say shock, but the kind of way when you thought there was a fail-safe and it didn't happen. And so there were clearly some people in that mode. There were other people clearly in the mode. They knew it wasn't going to happen. And that's why they planned for a violent event to take place. But in any case, this is pretty wild stuff. You have a former president basically telling people that on a near-term time horizon, he expects there is going to be a coup and that he will become president again. I mean, we have not had that before. And even if that sounds crazy, it is, I mean, it sounds crazy. It is crazy. It's the kind of thing that incites violence. And we know that the American right is capable not only of terroristic violence, but violence that at least has as its aim actually reordering who's running the country. So those two things are happening kind of on a similar timeline. The Democrats kind of pushing ahead. All right, we need to start passing our bills. And the ex-president saying he might be coming back to power soon. So those are two things we're going to talk about. We're also going to answer a couple more of your questions. And, you know, we're not going to do it in this episode, but I think we're going to do it in the next episode. We're going to have a contest. A kind of a cool contest where if you are a composer out there, we want a new theme song for the Josh Marshall podcast. And you know, the one, I actually like the one we have right now. It's not a pinnacle of music composition in the Western tradition, but I mean, it's kind of, I like the beat, right? But we want something unique. We want something that's just ours. And so, you know, we've done this a few times in the past over the course of the history of TPM. You know, we actually, years ago when we wanted a Golden Duke statuette, I kind of did a thing like this and we had a, you know, there is always a reader who has some, talent for this. And there was a sculptor who we paid to make the Golden Duke statuettes. So he actually did it as, you know, sculpted them and did it as a metal, you know, you create the sculpture and then you create a mold out of the sculpture and then you pour metal into the mold. That's how you get the Golden Duke statuette. So we're going to do a contest like this. And, we'll pay the person for it. You know, it's not going to be a big commission, but we don't expect it to be for free. And then we'll have a new theme song and all that kind of cool stuff. So anyway, we're going to talk about that next week. That's going to be, we're going to announce that contest, but that's coming. So before we get started, let me remind you that it is spring and spring is a great time to drink a Grady's Cold Brew iced coffee. There's Frisbee, there's Frisbees, barbecues, picnics, some variation of all those things, and iced coffee. So ring in the springtime. It's kind of, I guess we're technically in summer now, so we need new ad copy. In any case, let's not break the moment. Ring in springtime with Grady's New Orleans style cold brew kit. You just add water to the reusable store and pour pouch and brew overnight for velvety smooth coffee you can drink iced or hot. Bring it to the park, take it camping. You can even add a shot of vodka if you're feeling adventurous. Hey, it's spring. You're allowed to do that kind of stuff. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. So, Kate, what's up?
So I guess we'll start of those dual tracks. We'll start in the Senate where, like you said, we're approaching a June work period. And before they jetted off for the holiday weekend, Schumer said he said that the work period will be, quote, extremely challenging. I want to be clear that the next few weeks will be hard and will test our resolve as a Congress and a conference. And then in that Dear Colleague letter, he laid out some of the things he's going to bring to the floor, which include the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is meant to address the gender gap. Republicans filibustered this bill in 2012 and 2014. The Judge Brown Jackson to fill Garland's seat on the DC Circuit Court. He mentioned gun legislation, LGBTQ equality legislation, and of course, the For the People Act, the big voting rights package. So named all of that to come in this month, which with the exception of Judge Jackson's confirmation, which seems pretty surprisingly signed, sealed, delivered at this point. She got two Republican votes out of committee. You could have expected maybe a little more backlash, seeing that she is pretty openly known to be on the list of Supreme Court possibilities should a vacancy arise. But
just tell us briefly who she is.
Her name is Ketanji Brown Jackson. So aside from that, everything else he said is, you know, seems to be a pretty much dead on arrival with the filibuster the way it is right now. Even the stuff as vague as, you know, gun legislation. I mean, when have we seen anything with guns go anywhere?
I almost think it's funny. I mean, obviously there's a lot of pressure from Democrats to do something on that front. I almost do wonder, that stands out from the other things on that list, because the other things in that list are things that virtually every Democrat, if not literally every Democrat, supports. So they are things that basically have Democrats saying, we are ready to go. It is only you Republicans filibustering. Whereas like gun legislation, it's a little hard to get all Democrats to agree on something. And like, you don't want to, I'm not sure, there's not really much point to say, hey, let's do a big lengthy negotiation and have it be a little painful because, you know, Joe Manchin or John Tester need to kind of go somewhere they're not totally comfortable. And the people from blue states need to kind of, you know, give up with a lot of things they want. If we know it's not passing anyway. So I almost kind of wonder at a certain level, kind of what's the point there. But in any case, so is the idea that you're going to have four or five filibusters and that is the point to kind of let's just make 100% clear that these things will not happen if you, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema don't show some flexibility on the filibuster. That's basically the idea.
Yeah, I mean, what we know about time-wise is he said Paycheck Fairness Act is coming up like as soon as they get back. And then we know that the For the People Act is coming the week of June 21st. So that kind of lays out a timeline where you can see, starting with the paycheck one, putting in all this other stuff, LGBTQ, all this stuff is going to get filibustered, and then kind of crescendoing on the For the People Act using the strategy you just said, you know, watching Republicans do the obstruction, not just the threat of obstruction, time again. And then end with this, you know, what Democrats have branded as the only stopgap to the existential threat facing our democracy, that if this package doesn't get passed and, you know, Democrats lose the House or the Senate in the midterms, you know, that's it. Democracy is over. America, as we know it, is done. So, you know, I think you can kind of see it sketched out to be this rolling ball of momentum that comes to its focal point on this package. And it's all kind of, I think, colored by the fact that we just watched the first filibuster be carried out. And, you know, there is something different about watching it happen versus what we had before, which was stuff never even got to the floor because of, you know, the threat of the filibuster. We knew it would be filibustered, you know, but there's something about watching totally. The vote tick off.
And that is something that I know congressional Democrats, Senate Democrats have really gotten wrong, that you can't expect that anybody in the country who is not, you know, political junkies are highly partisan. You don't have like, oh, I'm a political junkie, but I'm just kind of wishy-washy and ideological. It doesn't work that way. So the people who are plugged in are already firmly in one camp or another. And it is just deeply naive about human nature and politics to think that it is the same thing to say, oh, well, we can't bring that up because they're going to filibuster it, versus actually making them do it. And as we know, unfortunately, making them do it is still very easy. There were only 35 votes against. On the commission bill, I believe six Republicans voted for it. Two Democrats were not there. Big question. I mean, they both said they had a family thing. Come the fuck on, right? I mean, when we have when just to speak in our own little TPM world, on election night, it's got to be a pretty big family issue for someone to say, can't be there, right? I mean, it's got to be, you know, and this is kind of like, this is your job. Like, where the fuck were you?
Yeah. And those two Democrats, just for our listeners, were Patty Murray of Washington and Kyrsten Sinema, of course, of Arizona. And also a funny detail of that, there was 11 total senators who decided the long weekend was more important than sticking around for this vote. And one of them was also Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, a Republican, whose staff said, well, he would have voted to break the filibuster, but he wasn't here, which cracked me up because it's like such this backdoor way to be like, he would have done the right thing.
Yeah. And this is something that I always want to make sure people understand, that there could have been no votes against this and it still would have failed. Like, if every Democrat had been there, and let's say Toomey's telling the truth and he would have been 57, there could have been 57 votes and no votes against, and it still would have failed. And the key there is it shows you that the current system asks absolutely nothing of the blocking opposition. It's not that they have to produce 40 votes. The people who want to pass something have to produce 60 votes. And so just the incentives are all wrong. Now, in practice, on a vote like this, it is galling, but it doesn't make a huge difference. But in practice, it would, because we currently have this 60-40 rule, and that's bad for all the reasons we know. But let's say if you kept it more or less the same, but had the rule be the opposition has to produce 40 votes on the floor. And if it were the case, like kind of like on an hour's notice, you got to produce this. Well, that would change the situation dramatically, because then Chuck Schumer would say, okay, didn't get it this time, but I'm going to keep bringing this up, and maybe I'll bring it up on a Saturday with no heads up, and I'll get my 60 votes here, and I guess, again, the point is you don't need your 60 votes. You need your 40 votes.
Right.
And so if that, even that were changed, you would still have the same 60-40 thing, but by just changing who's responsible for what, because over time, it's pretty hard to have 40 people available at a moment's notice indefinitely. You're going to have a time when someone's away, or they just can't get everybody there in time. It would make a big difference. So in this case, it's just, again, they weren't that far. If you take Toomey at his word, that's 57 votes. That's not that far.
Well, and even, you know, without kind of the subterfuge element of it, there would probably come a time where a Republican would just decide it's not worth it. You know, filibustering doesn't outweigh their campaign events or their fundraisers or whatever they're going to do. The craziest thing is a lot of people were kind of tweeting, here are other votes that have been, you know, the filibuster successfully blocked. And it's just kind of galling because you see what would otherwise be considered like fairly healthy bipartisan votes, you know, not bipartisan of like ye old days, but bipartisan of high 50s.
Yeah, not like one person, not like Murkowski or Romney or something like that. No. And again, the point is that you make it constant when there is literally no cost, right. Not even the slightest effort. Because as you say, if in that other model, it would really have to be something where Republicans would indefinitely, for the remainder of the Congress, make sure that they are always available whenever, you know, in the way the calendar works, whenever Schumer had the possibility of just calling a quick vote. And I guarantee you, unless it were something like, you know, something truly, earth shattering, a lot of Republicans would say, dude, this is getting old. I want to go home. I need to go to a fundraiser. Enough of this shit. And so that is, you know, going back to, you know, we had that briefing a couple months ago, and I want to have him back. We had that briefing about the filibuster. There are lots of ways that you could not only preserve just the name filibuster, but even preserve the things that really suck about it, that a majority can basically run the show in the Senate and still change things in a pretty big way by making these, you know, pretty small differences. But again, at a minimum, you should make them do it. Even if they don't have to talk forever, you should make them do it.
And part of that argument that Adam Gentleson made to us in that insider briefing was also, you know, these reforms have the capacity to make bipartisanship more frequent rather than less, which is the constant argument we hear from Manchin and Sinema. But, you know, the idea being you need to be on the floor more, you're going to see the other people more. You know, maybe the pain in the ass 40 votes every Saturday gets old enough that you're like, you know what, maybe I will genuinely try to get some Republican, you know, priorities in here. Just, you know, Sinema again, I think just this week actually talked to reporters for once and said, you know, when the system isn't working, you fix your behavior. You don't change the rules. And
yeah,
it's just,
she is so awful. She is so awful. I know that we don't have this podcast, so I can say that people are awful, but man, she is just awful. And, you know, I think for most Democrats, their preference is just no. Let's pass our agenda with 50 votes. That's the solution. Not getting big, watered down bipartisan votes. But if bipartisanship matters to you, there is zero question that weakening the filibuster is what you want. Because if you had that model that we just discussed, where the minority had to show up with 40 votes on a moment's notice, what would happen is not that, you know, whoever your generic Republican is would suddenly say, okay, I'm going to vote for your bill. What it would be is on something like, you know, infrastructure or something or whatever it was, you would have a bunch of Republicans go to, you know, Manchin or maybe Dianne Feinstein or, you know, kind of these kind of more centrist Democrats and say, hey, okay, you pull your support from the Democratic bill. And let's come up with something that we can get 50 votes for, kind of a mix of Democrats and a mix of Republicans, pull it to the right, but not so far to the right that no Democrats will be for it. And then we'll pass that and that'll be it. That is how legislation works. And that's why you seldom have, without this ridiculous rule, you seldom have votes that are 50-50 like that in a presidential system. But anyway.
And I mean, this problem might become even more pressing because there was this kind of quiet parliamentarian ruling that came out just before or even during the long weekend where, you know, and again, this stuff has been pretty closely held. So there's only been some details kind of trickling out and reporting. But one of the things she said is it can't just be auto-discharged out of the committee. So usually if there's a tie on these committees that have 50% Democrats, 50% Republicans, Schumer has like a kind of neat go-around where he can just take it right to the floor. But the problem is now, so that means you need the vote of someone on the Senate Budget Committee, a Republican on the Senate Budget Committee, to pass what they want to do through reconciliation out of committee. And that would also subject it to a voterama on the floor, which Republicans would probably use to make, you know, vulnerable Democrats take votes on kind of politically charged amendments.
So what is, tell us in practice, what is, mm-hmm. now, isn't the key issue here, maybe we're talking about a different thing, that basically the Democrats cannot use this new approach, this new theory to get like an unlimited number of reconciliation bills. They could basically only get one.
Right.
One more during this Congress.
And that's what Schumer was really pushing for. He thought he was trying to use this kind of clause in the underlying law to say, we can do endless reconciliation, exactly what you're saying. Whereas usually they're tied to, you know, how many budgets you can pass a year. So it's usually one a year. This time they got two because there wasn't a budget passed last year. But with these new kind of restrictions that she's putting around it, it just seems really unlikely that you're going to be able to eke out any more than one more vehicle via reconciliation, which just kind of loops back to what we were talking about, intensifies pressure on the filibuster because that was the one kind of Hail Mary escape route where maybe the filibuster wouldn't become the central fight of this term, but that is seeming more and more remote.
Well, isn't, okay, so my basic understanding here is that you're going to, and that's another question I have, how the infrastructure bill plays into June and July if we're doing all these, you know, if we're scheduling all these filibusters. But okay, so I guess that means that you can't break infrastructure up into, you know, five different reconciliation bills. You really got to do it as one big thing.
Right.
But in practice, most of these other bills have no budgetary dependencies. So they're not even in the ballpark for reconciliation. So how much does this really matter?
Right. I mean, this would matter, you're totally right, not on things like the LGBTQ stuff, voting rights stuff, not that. But, you know, the idea that maybe you could parcel infrastructure into multiple different bills and Biden could kind of claim all of those as legislative victories to fill the gap of that the filibuster is sustaining, you know, that's kind of right out the window. So then I think it puts things in starker focus. The idea that you're okay, you got one more shot via reconciliation, which of course entails all those strings as well. You got to get Manchin on board, got to get Sinema on board, but there isn't really another pathway for them to legislate after that point. It's just going to come down to the filibuster, and that's it.
Right. So it makes it a little more stark, but it doesn't really change things dramatically.
Not for a lot of the legislative priorities. Right. You're right. It's just that there's no real, I guess, now there's no backup plan. There's just no other way to legislate. You know, it's kind of going to come down to this fight over the filibuster / you know, I guess you would expect Biden to do all he can do unilaterally and through, you know, the regulatory agencies.
Right, right. Well, I know you haven't been up there for a bit, but to the extent you're talking to people on Capitol Hill, is there any optimism that this, you know, kind of June of filibusters is going to change anything?
You know, I don't know. I think, you know, we kind of watching what happened with the commission, we had Sinema and Manchin put out this statement imploring their Republican colleagues to vote with them. And then Manchin was all torn up afterwards and saying how upset he was. But, you know, it's just kind of interesting because right now, Democrats are waging these two different wars, right? It's like they're prepping this filibuster. They're trying to put more heat on this, which I think you can also see by the fact that Biden has charged VP Kamala Harris with voting rights, which seems to me to not mean anything really substantially other than we're putting more focus on this. We're heating this up. You know, we're preparing for war on this front. But then meanwhile, they're also trying to do infrastructure in a way that gets these same Democratic senators on board. So it's like this tightrope where, you know, I assume you don't want to piss off Manchin when you also need him for this other thing, which about a half hour before we came on air, Washington Post had a report that Biden offers tax concession and infrastructure talks today with Shelley Moore Capito, where he said he'd be okay with a plan for $1 trillion in new spending financed through tax changes that do not appear to raise the top corporate rate, which previous, you know, which was the plan for the main funding stream to this, which seems to me to just be kind of a way to show Manchin, we offered so much. This was a huge concession. They didn't do anything.
Do we know what, I mean, what are the other, are there other things besides fees? I mean, I guess that gets back to, and I think you mentioned this last week, that Republicans seem to be, the Republican plan seems to be to take corporate tax cuts off the table and sort of back the Democrats into other taxes, which would break their tax pledges about no taxes, you know, no new taxes for people making less than $400,000 a year. So back them into breaking a promise and then run against them on the promise, even though they don't even support the bill.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the details in this report say he suggested a minimum corporate tax of 15%. Trying to go after the corporations that pay basically nothing now, and then stepping up enforcement on corporations and wealthy earners who rely on tax loopholes. But, you know, I don't know. I would be shocked if this ends up coming to anything. I think these are all just like data points that Biden is collecting so he can say, I gave them the world and they still wouldn't come together. You know, what more do you want from me, Joe Manchin?
Right. Well, my understanding of where these negotiations are is that, setting aside the taxes, Biden has come way down to $1 trillion for hard infrastructure. Republicans are still down at $200 billion. So they're not even like in the, I mean, and they haven't moved at all. I mean, if anything, they moved down because at least the top line at the beginning was, okay, we're willing to do $500 or $600 billion. But when it actually, you know, when it actually got down to saying what these things would be and not just like, you know, recounting other things, that it got down to, again, like $200 billion, which is again, Biden started at what, like 1.7? I mean, so I was reading something this morning in one of the papers saying it's not just that they're not making progress, they're going backwards. And if anything, the question now is whether it is just how to end these negotiations without excessively hurting everybody's feelings, basically. So it's not great.
Yeah. So let's transition outside the Senate to the Trump world, where, as Josh said at the top, his high-tech 2021 earth-shattering blog has been shuttered, much to the dismay of the couple thousand people who read it. But the kind of the funniest thing about this to me is the goalpost shifting that's been around this blog. Because at the beginning, if you remember, it was kind of hailed as there's going to be this new social media platform that Trump is going to, you know, clown the opposition kind of thing. And then we get this blog, which isn't even really a very high tech blog because you can't, you know, the commenting features are very rudimentary. I was reading this deep dive of it where the kind of, you can heart the posts, but literally all the code is doing is like filling in the coloring the heart red. It doesn't,
so it's
do
not actually
else.
Like, I mean, even, I mean, I'll tell you, you know, the even a TPM, like when you do the equivalent of hearting the post, that is saved. And
yeah,
a number
exactly.
is created. So this isn't just like, you know, changing a, yeah. So pretty primitive stuff. And now it's done.
and it came out and was panned. And then Jason Miller was like, no, that's not the social media platform. The social media platform is still coming and it's going to blow Facebook and Twitter out of the water, which like the part of that that's also funny to me is just the classic Trumpian arrogance of saying like, we are going to build a social media empire that can compete with these massive companies that took, you know, years and millions of dollars of development, but we're going to just whip it up really quick and it's going to be a competitor.
And so they're saying now this was just meant as a sort of like a you know, palate cleanser for the big thing.
That's the talk now.
Yeah, that he was just upset that the traffic was so low and yeah. So anyway, let's get on to the coup. We have to talk about the coup.
Right. Yeah. So we, like you said, there's the New York Times reporting that he'll be back in the White House by August. And then we kind of have...
Well, let's be fair to the Times. They're not saying he will be back. He is telling
people
he will be back. Right.
Right. Right. And then meanwhile, he's planning to start up his rallies again, which I think will be kind of interesting because Trump's deplatforming has been like super effective in taking his voice out of the debate. So now it's going to kind of be interesting to see if especially media outlets have, you know, learned the 2016 lessons and is it just going to kind of convert now into giving Trump a ton of free ink and free airtime at these rallies? Like, I'm inclined to think no, just because even at the end, like they just started getting so boring and so repetitive and even Trump's shock value kind of wore off. But I mean, that's the way I guess he's going to push himself back into the public eye before this, you know, coming August date where he thinks he'll be back in the White House. And then you kind of have the reliable few, Michael Flynn's, you know, he was at the For God and Country Patriot Roundup at Dallas this week, which was like a QAnon conference. And he said then to a questioner that there's nothing stopping a Myanmar-like coup from happening in the United States. And in fact, it should happen here. So, you know, Trump's kind of devoted people have been waiting for this, you know, forever for the grand reinstatement. And it seems that date keeps moving when it doesn't happen. But, you know, for at least some, I'm sure they're bolstering these hopes.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that these rallies will be covered probably live on Fox News. I don't know about that. It kind of depends how they, you know, it'll depend on what the viewership is. I mean, I think, you know, one thing is we have not seen, I mean, we saw that one, I guess he spoke at CPAC, but we haven't seen rallies when Trump is just some dude. He doesn't control anything. He can't, you know, and that is what, I mean, obviously he had the rallies during the 2016 campaign, but a lot of the electricity of the rallies during his presidency was the fact that if he says something crazy, he can go back and do something crazy because he has all the power. That will be different. I also wonder though, I mean, I have always been a little resistant to this idea that, you know, the press is doing him some big favor by focusing on this stuff. I have never really been convinced that that is the case for a number of different reasons. But in this moment, I am very curious. Will this be a good thing for Trump? Will it be a good thing for Republicans to have him out there saying this stuff? It's not clear to me that that's the case. And it's not, I don't know. I mean, it is certainly nice not to have his voice in our ears or in our head, right? But it's not clear to me, it's just not clear to me that it is actually helpful for them. I don't know. I mean, is he going to say about how he's, you know, about how these audits are going or about how he's, you know, going to be reinstalled in the White House? I don't know. And again, the one more thing I'll say about that on this whole issue of, are we, you know, amplifying Trump, which is a whole construct that I don't think that is a good way to think about how politics works. If he is out there, basically in his own ecosystem, raising the expectation that he is going to be reinstalled in office, it's good to know about that. And I don't think that, you know, the people who are going to get violent for Trump, they're not relying on CNN to find out what he's saying. They've got OAN, they've got Fox, they've got Newsmax. There's a whole, you know, there is a mindset among liberals, also among the establishment press, and in a way that those are not at all overlapping, that if we, you know, if he's deplatformed, he kind of doesn't exist. Well, it's not really true. He does have ways that his messages get out, and his messages can get out even if they're not from him. So anyway, that whole thing about, you know, is CNN going to report his every comment? I think that is in many ways, a sort of a misanalysis of how politics and communication actually works.
I would say that you're definitely right for like the 35% who are ride or die Trump. I think the danger of, you know, his amplification is that it strengthens his grip on the party. And if you're someone who thinks Trump is bad for America, then having a Trumpy Republican Party is bad for America. But that being said, I mean, he was booted from the White House after being a one-term president, and Republicans seem to have absolutely no inclination to distance themselves from him at all. So maybe that concern is not as real. You know, I was just kind of thinking while you were talking, we've seen the amplification of lesser figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance, has obviously become such kind of a subject of curiosity that her platform has become very raised. You know, she fundraises a ton. But that's more of an argument to be made, I guess, about the coverage of Trump in 2016 more than the coverage of Trump now. You know, it's like, what, you're going to amplify him? He was president. He's as amplified as it gets. I guess what'll be interesting to me is to see if his power actually increases with these rallies over these kind of, you know, weak sauce statements that he blasts out, being like mad at various states' election officials. Those don't seem to have a huge punch. I do wonder if seeing those kind of threats on TV, if that's more effective, if that's more powerful. But I think I agree with you that the difference is probably somewhat negligible. You know, it's just going to be interesting because if he starts this again, all the speculation all the time is going to be, is this the 2024 campaign, which is, especially as he gets in kind of increasing looming legal trouble, seems to be within his best interests. So, I mean, I think that's going to be kind of the most interesting piece.
Well, it is, you know, it is a TPM alum. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot too, but a TPM alum, Benji Sarlin, mentioned this on Twitter, that there is this very, the shuttering of the blog, there is this very weird dual action that is happening right now in the country, that Trump is, and this is in some ways registered by the lack of traffic to the blog, he is becoming less and less, he's just kind of off the map for the country at large. People just are not paying attention to him. He did a Newsmax interview or something like that, and it got like no ratings. I mean, he's really old news for the country. And yet in the Republican Party is still back in October. You know, he's becoming more central in the Republican Party. And that thing is, I think it doesn't seem that weird to people because we're living in it. It's the world we live in. And the world you live in does, by definition, doesn't seem that weird. But it's weird. It's weird that that's happening. And that has lots of weird implications, because it does show that the Republican Party, it may have already been more, you know, very extreme and all this kind of stuff, but it is disengaging from the rest of the country. And maybe you can say the rest of the country is disengaging from it. They are moving apart in a way that is not simply ideological or political. It's again that is a bubble where Trump is still 100% of everything. There is only Trump. There is that thing where Rona McDaniel put out that thing a couple days ago. If Trump's grievances about the debate commission are not addressed, the Republican, just again, Trump. He's becoming more central within the Republican universe, even as he, again, it's not even a matter of opposed by everyone else. Everyone else, he's just not on the radar. Everyone else just is not even thinking about him. So that's weird. And it does raise some questions about whether 2022 will be precisely how everyone expects. If there is that kind of, if self-identified Republicans really are operating in such a different world than the rest of, not just Democrats, but kind of everyone else who's not in the Republican bubble.
Yeah. Okay. We're running short on time. Let's move on to questions. Our first comes from Robert, who says, in terms of Biden and the Democrats moving legislation through Congress, filibuster issue aside, I don't remember the time for doing that, or at least the perception of how much time there is to do that, as discussed by political journalists, being as short as it seems to be now. Does that match your sense of it, or was I not paying close enough attention during Obama or the second Bush terms? So the key of this is what we've been kind of talking about on the show, which is that, well, up to this point anyway, you can say the COVID relief package was passed really quickly. Urgency has been kind of undergirding a lot of the infrastructure conversation as well, even if it's not as easy an argument to make as with COVID, when the threat was clearly so crushing and existential. I do think, though, it's not just in Robert's head here. I think there are like a few factors that contribute to the speed with which they want to pass everything. Part of that is, as we've talked about a lot of times, the 2022 midterms creates a very short window in which they can get things passed, or in which they guarantee Democratic control. I think there's also the piece of lessons learned from the Obama administration, where, Biden especially and a lot of the people working for him had a close-up view of what happens when Republicans have the incentive to kind of slow walk legislation, pretending they're going to cooperate for ages. And then you end up with, for them, it was the ACA, a watered down version of that initial legislation with months burned off the clock, political capital gone. And I think they're not trying to do that as well. And then I think there's also, kind of a morbid part of this, which is that it's a 50-50 Senate, and the average age of a senator is 64.3 years old, which means we've got a lot of really old people in these seats that are, one kind of health disaster away from losing the majority. And, that played a role in Obama, too. If you remember, in 2009, they were just shy of a filibuster proof majority. But then you had the Al Franken fight take 8 months to resolve, and he finally got seated in June. And then 2 months later, Ted Kennedy died and was replaced by a Republican. So I think there's also the lesson that the majority you have might not be, is not going to live forever. And there can be right. unforeseen things that could, can totally, imagine if a Democratic senator died right now, that's it. That's it. So I think those are all pieces of it.
Yeah, I think. And just on the to the Ted Kennedy front, there was a slight detail there that he died. A replacement was, unless I'm totally getting this wrong, replacement was appointed by what was then, I guess it was Deval Patrick. And then there was a special election. The Democrats lost a special election. So same basic thing, but a slight detail. I would say, I think everything Kate said is absolutely right. You've got the precariousness of both the chronological precariousness of the Democratic majority, the potential health precariousness of the Democratic majority. You have got just the memory of everything that happened under Obama. But I think there's one other thing that I would add, and that is that even among Democrats, back in 2009, 2010, there was a pretty big debate among Democrats about what the what turned out to be Obamacare would look like. And some of this is we're not even talking about we're not operating in regular what the insiders call regular order, where you've got committee hearings and you've got negotiate all these kind of stuff. By and large, the Democrats know what they're trying to do. There's really very little negotiation among Democrats over any policy issues. On the infrastructure stuff, there's some stuff about scope, what the price tag is, since Manchin is so key, a lot of the climate stuff. But basically, we're not, again, things generally take a long time because regular order takes a long time. You have a committee process. You mark up a bill. All of the, you know, that all takes a lot of time. But in none of these cases are you talking about anything like that. There's no markup. There's no committee. Anything. The Democrats know exactly what they want to do right now, and there's really, Manchin notwithstanding, there's not even that much disagreement about what they want to do. The key is just whether they'll do it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I.e. the filibuster. And that creates that creates a kind of a very different kind of time dynamic, because it's one thing if, and my apologies for interrupting you, Kate. It's one thing if it's one thing if you're saying, all right, you know, we're passing this massive bill and the process just takes 4 months to mark it up, to do this, to do that, blah, 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 blah. But that's not the case. And so here with infrastructure, if you're not doing it in June, when are you going to do it? Because the only thing now is, are you going to allow the filibuster to remain in place? And if you're not going to do it now, are you going to be more willing to change the filibuster rules in 6 months? Of course not. So that, I think, makes the urgency issue have a very different character, even though your memory is basically right. Legislation takes a while, and that's nothing new. So that is, I think, one other additional factor in addition to the, you know, precariousness of the majority and you know, a lot of senators being over 80 and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and a big piece of that is that there are simply fewer red state Democrats to contend with. You know, it's Manchin's the big one. For Obama, like you say, with these, you know, kind of internal Democratic debates, a lot of that was because we had more conservative Democratic senators than we do now. But, you know, a byproduct of the hyper polarization we're in is that everything is a lot more self-sorted now. So you just don't have that same kind of ideological difference within one party.
And one, you know, one kind of final point on that, that in that period, you had red state or centrist Democrats who did want it to be bipartisan, but to a significant extent connected to their wanting it to be bipartisan is that they wanted policy that was significantly less liberal than the rest of their caucus. So those two things played together. Right. And one of the weird things about the current moment with Manchin is that in most cases, he's not meaningfully saying he wants the policy to be different. He just wants Republicans to support it, which creates a certain level of absurdity to the process that was not as clearly the case back in 2009, 2010.
Right. Okay. So our last question, comes from Kevin. It's about propaganda. He said he's been recently reading probably his 100th book about World War II and was struck by the description of the citizens of Berlin, completely shocked that the evil, aggressive British were bombing them. They'd been so conditioned by state-run media to believe in their own virtue and infallibility. And then he kind of transitions to our current day and says he's most concerned about the distorted picture that Fox News and worse are sending out, but the left is not above distortion. There's some clear differences here. Fox News isn't state run. There is no quote unquote official news. People have multiple sources of information and are largely choosing the news that sounds sweetest. What do you think can be done about it? I'm following the lawsuits by Dominion, which seem to have a minor impact, but I don't think issuing Pinocchios is having much effect.
I think that is right. It is not having much effect. And I don't think there is much we can or even should be trying to do about it in that sense. And what I mean by that is, first of all, we have a First Amendment. You cannot, you know, we have a whole debate about social media platforms and everything, but you have a right to say things that are bullshit. You do. You just do. The First Amendment means nothing if you don't. Now, there are limitations. You can't libel people. That is a civil matter. But basically, you cannot stop people from saying things that are bullshit. And that is what the First Amendment is for. That is not a distortion of the First Amendment. But the reality is, as I think Kevin was saying there, I see a lot of people saying, well, we need more education on media literacy, or we need, kind of better fact checking. But I think the reality is that people, this is not a confusion. This is not that people are fundamentally being misled. People want to hear, particularly people of a more authoritarian mindset, although it is certainly not this phenomena is not absent on the left. There's a version of it. It's just much more muted. You have a lot of people who want to be told lies. They want to be told what reinforces what they believe. And to a certain extent, belief becomes a weapon. If I say, I think the election was stolen and Donald Trump is the real president, do I really think that as a factual matter, that more people voted for Donald Trump and there was a conspiracy that took away a lot of his votes? I'm not so sure a lot of people really think that as a factual matter, but it is a form of aggression to say it. So I think that the whole idea of belief is one that we need to think a little more critically about. It is not just a matter of people are saying, wow, I thought Fox News really given it to me straight. And now it turns out that it was all lies. And thank you for clarifying that for me, because now I'm going to tune in to CNN. This isn't a matter of like, people don't have enough media literacy. People want to believe something and they go to the people who tell them stuff that feels good to believe, and that that belief again can operate as a weapon for a lot of people. So having said that, once people get tuned into their own media worlds, they can be told stuff that is they can kind of be bamboozled, right, and start and be told and conditioned to believe some stuff that is not true. So it does play a role, but I think fundamentally we have a political division in this country, and that is the issue. And people watching Fox News and repeating the bullshit that they hear on Fox News or One America Network or all these kind of places is an effect of that political division. It is not the driver of it. So to a great extent, I don't think there's anything to do about it.
An interesting piece of the question to me was the difference between kind of the state-run top-down propaganda, of the Nazis versus what we have now, which I think the current landscape is so much stickier and harder to sort out because, what Fox News does, and it's kind of, right-hand men, Newsmax, OAN, all of Facebook, all of that kind of stuff. What it does is it kind of Bannon's term, to flood the zone with, I think he said, with shit. But the idea being that you put out so much doubt and so many conspiracy theories, and you just cast suspicion over everything with the hope that people will come out the other end overwhelmed, cynical, no grounding to know what's truth or not. Nothing's truth. Everything's truth, The idea being that people are just kind of so disillusioned that it's easy to tell them this person is actually very sinister and working against you, because you've already kind of created this atmosphere where, and Fox News does this especially because they only speak the language of war. Everything is you and your way of life versus them and the way of life they want to impose on you. So then it's just this landscape where you can't trust anything, and you know that there's an existential threat to your way of life, even if it manifests in things that seem so silly to people who aren't on the Fox News diet. And, you tune in and see a segment about beef restrictions and you can laugh at it and that's stupid. But when you're kind of steeped in that world, I think all of these things are just different fronts in this war, different proof that people are coming for you. And then I think it just leaves you with this activated kind of space of the citizenry that is has been told for a long time that, you know, they have grounds to feel mortally afraid of their way of life. And that a lot of that is, you know, based in prior prejudices, which makes it easier to kind of scapegoat different groups as the real enemies here. But, you know, whereas with the Nazis, it's just you're kind of getting everything from one source. Now it's like you have multiple sources, but what they're mostly doing is trying to confuse you and to mix everything up and to make you believe nothing and to make you believe that everybody is that kind of secretly coming to get you. And then I just think that primes people so well for somebody like Trump or some other Trump-like figure who kind of confirms that, says, yeah, you're right, like American carnage, you know, the country is going to hell. And I think that fear kind of helps people rally around him.
Yeah, I definitely, I mean, again, I think a lot of this is self-selection. You get bamboozled, but it's because you largely chose, because that fit with your needs to be bamboozled in that way. But I do think you're right. And this is actually something I've been sort of reading up on and exploring, that there is a strategy, perhaps an intuitive strategy, to say so many things that are fake that you are trying to disillusion people, or undermine people's confidence that there is anything that is real or not real or any way to really know. So you're kind of, you know, there's a meta level there. And it's funny, there was actually I happened on a quote recently that is from Jean-Paul Sartre's book, Anti-Semite and Jew, which is a study of anti-Semitism. I think he wrote in the 50s or something like that. And in any case, this quote was basically that anti-Semites know that a lot of stuff they're saying is not true. But they also know that the people they're arguing with are committed to a kind of a rational discourse. They have to keep, the people they're arguing with have to keep arguing within that framework. And so a certain number of the things that these people are saying are just trying to fuck with you, kind of waste your time to wear you down. And I don't want to get hung up on here on saying these people are anti-Semites, but I think they are part of a similar part of the right and the mentality of the right. So I think there is that, parallel. And you see a lot of this in the discourse of social media, that a lot of what trolls are trying to do are just take the chessboard and throw it up in the air, right? They're not really trying to argue a case. They're trying to sow a kind of a chaos and confusion that is both a power in itself and also, again, demoralizes or confuses or wears everybody out in a way that it can amount to more power for them. Okay.
And on that note,
I need to remind you about Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee is the sponsor of the Josh Marshall Podcast. If you are ready to give it a try, you can get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM.
All right.
Send us your questions. And get ready for the song contest.
Yeah. Start brainstorming some melodies.
Yeah. Talk at Talking Points Memo for your questions for the podcast. All right. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Later.